Before we start our episode today, this is just a reminder. History Hack does have a Patreon account and all of your donations are gratefully appreciated. There's lots of perks on there, secret groups on Facebook. Do get involved. We would love to see more of you. Enjoy the episode today. Hello and welcome to the Mary Rose. I feel like I've not been here for ages, and it's probably because I've not been here for ages. We've got a show for you tonight, a short one probably by our standards, but let's get this out of the way. I suppose there is a birthday in the house today, but this person is really shy and retiring and just doesn't like any attention to be the center of attention. So we'll just, guys, should we just skip past it?
No.
She's already like, no, worship me. Beth, happy birthday.
Thank you, Alex.
Happy birthday, Beth. Happy
Thank
birthday.
You.
She is already on it, which is quite funny because you've got a tour tomorrow, haven't you?
Yeah.
Okay, we'll see how that works out. And we hate his guts because Kit is coming at us from the Caribbean coast.
I am in Santa Marta, Colombia. It's about 33 degrees at the moment. Very nice. I'm in a rooftop bar. It's lovely.
So Zach is the nicest person in the room and he's shaking his head as if to say, bastard.
Yeah, pretty much. I'd give a lot of money to be on a beach right now, not having to think about stuff. But I'm quite enjoying being your chief of staff, as the Great War Group trustees have named me.
The trustees have decided you are my chief of staff, which I quite like.
Apparently this makes me Ludendorff, but that doesn't really mean much to me.
No, we don't want to know. No, because then that makes... Who does that make me? Hindenburg.
You could be Hoffman.
No, let's be Kitchener and Robertson in that little bit of time before Kitchener drowns and Lloyd George becomes a total nightmare. You're Wooly, basically. That's your nickname.
Okay, this doesn't mean a great deal to me because, like, all the important stuff ends in 1815, but...
You are, to be fair, you are near a beach, aren't you, Zach?
I am. I'm down on the south coast, but it is not 30-something degrees, that's for sure.
Excellent. We have Charlie with us. She's different today. She's got a straight fringe today, and it's weirding me out. She's gone all, like, sweeping fringy. She almost looks like she belongs in the 21st century and not in the 1950s, which is just bizarre for me. Charlie, how are you doing?
I'm good. I've been in the kitchen all day, so I've actually been cooking and making cakes, so...
Oh, so it's wilted.
Suffered.
Yeah. Excellent. We've got Chris, who no longer has any hair.
No. This way I don't have to get it cut again till April.
Excellent. We're rocking the monk look again by then. How is Gillingham?
Still a festering sore on the arse of humanity, but still better than Sheppey, so it's doing all right.
Excellent. And we have Clive. Lovely Clive.
Hi, Alex. I'm just terribly excited at the moment.
Why?
Because I'm going to the Great War Group conference next week. This I don't know why, other than to see all of you lovely people and to spectate at the game of Naked Twister.
Well, we need to follow you up with Holmes's mate, Glenn, because then you can be terrified of all the nerds together. Because he too, it's more at the novice end of the scale. But yeah, God help Maidstone. Because Lockie, we added it up. Isn't there going to be 13 of the History Hack crew in one place?
Well, you might be going to Maidstone. I'll go to Maidenhead. And we'll
see. That's the one. My brain, brain is
you've
so
got dodgy Medway towns on the brain. Have you? No, we've got a fairly full house of oafs. It's going to be legendary.
Yeah, it is. Zach says he thought Clive was going to be the key player in Naked Twister. No, Clive. You know Clive. He'll be standing there handing out disclaimers and waivers for people to sign before they get, as we don't get sued. That's why he's coming. That and to point and laugh at the rest of us. And last but not least, we've got Holmes with us.
Evening.
That's Collywood.
Hey, so I've been out today. I've been to Richmond today.
Oh, that's about as far as you can go, because we established earlier this week, didn't we, that basically your son is a pain in the arse because you can't go anywhere because he's 17 and only vaccinated once.
Yeah, that doesn't seem to open any doors anywhere in Europe. I think we can do France, actually. I think we can do France, but I don't know if we can do Belgium.
Can you just not leave him with the tramps outside the Carrefour by Lille station and pop up to Ypres for a night?
I think after half an hour of his very intense FIFA 22 talk, they'll be asking him to move on in France.
Excellent. Okay, we have decided tonight, or we decided several weeks ago, Zach decided. Zach, tell everyone what the topic is today.
The topic still kind of remains to be decided, which is not incredibly helpful in the sense that we're talking about saints. Clive looks horrified. So we're talking about saints, so don't worry. But we couldn't quite decide if we were going for greatest saints or wackiest saints. So I guess we're just going to kind of leave that up to Holmes and let him do the technical stuff.
Are we gunning for the most batshit crazy saint in history?
Pretty much what I was thinking. Yes. You know, there's got to be some weird kind of individual. Yeah. I'm hoping that Dorman's going to rock up at some point and knock it out the park with some Irish saint. That's kind of as far as I got in my head.
Yeah, we don't want to do the best, i.e. most sensible saint, because that'd be really
that'd just
dull,
be boring.
Yeah.
Surely that goes against everything the Down the Pub stands for, sensible.
Yeah,
this is history.
We want something probably pervy, totally inappropriate. And if we haven't had someone talking about knobs, it's 7:14 now. If we haven't had knobs by 7:30, we're doing it wrong, aren't we?
Does that mean you want me to go first?
Lockie's just looking at the camera as if to say, I could just get one out if you want. That's his rubber.
Have you got St. Priapus?
Right, okay. Holmes, you're going to judge this one alone tonight. Holmes, why don't you pick who goes first? Who would you like? God, you'd be all omnipotent. Who would you like to hear from first, Judge Holmes?
I don't know, because they normally will go. I think we go Clive first.
Marvellous. Just on the basis that you can just count me then, that's fine.
Yeah, pretty much so. And also, if you need a new excuse to moan about not winning, so I'm giving you one here.
Brilliant. Thank you for that.
Before we start, is Bertie's snoring actually coming out on the recording? Are we okay?
I've got that was my stomach.
If Jabba's snoring behind my laptop as well, so that's cancelling it out. If I can't hear anything.
Excellent. Have at it, Clive.
Okay. Well, let's start by defining what a saint is. The word means simply holy. And in the early church, all Christians who had received the sacrament of baptism were holy and therefore saints. As time went by, no doubt influenced by the less than perfect Christians that abounded, the term morphed into one which recognized those special people who were so holy that they were accepted, with or without a short period in purgatory, into heaven. While many souls no doubt deserve this title, the church only recognizes those that can be demonstrated to be in heaven. And this occurs through evidence of their status, through post-mortem miracles that occur after prayers are directed to them, asking them to intercede with God on the supplicant's behalf. This is, of course, entirely logical. If your saint is in heaven, she or he can speak directly to God and can arrange a solution to your temporal problems. Certain saints have particular interests and become patron saints. It's only in the past 400 years that the process of canonization has become rigidly formalized, with people becoming venerable, then blessed, before gaining the saintly title. That said, more people are canonized today than ever before. The newly sainted JP II was responsible for more canonizations than the entire body of popes that preceded him. It should also be added that some saints, for example, Peter and Paul, were never canonized. They were acknowledged as saints by acclamation. Other earlier recognized saints were stripped of their titles after Vatican II in the 1960s because they were considered more likely to be myths than reality. St. Christopher and St. George both went as formal saints, but please don't tell Nigel Farage. Most of all, saints are examples of people who have lived good lives or at least achieved pretty obvious redemption. And it is that notion of example that is the most important. Hey guys, look at this person who lived a good and holy life and who is now enjoying all the perks of being sat next to God in heaven. Why not live a little bit more like him? Some saints are martyred, venerated for dying for their faith or in the practice of it. Some are doctors of the church, admired for their understanding and explanation of theological issues. Some, all women, are virgins, venerated from not shaggy under exceptional circumstances. Others are just people who have lived exemplary lives. The stories of the saints are a central part of Christian and particularly Catholic culture. Although there are probably more weird and wonderful saints in the Eastern Church, where Vatican II has played no part, and where the veneration of icons has an important role, as well as in some other non-Christian religions. The stories of some saints recount the gruesome manner of their torture or execution, or the bizarre miracles attributed to them after their deaths. These are fine and dandy stories, but don't really look at the person themselves, but rather what others did to them, or what happened after their lives. So, after that long preamble, I come to the saint that I have chosen, St. Simeon Stylites. St. Simeon was a great chap, head and shoulders above all others in his field, a pillar of the community. He was born around 390 Christian era at Sis in the Adana province of what is now Turkey, and died 69 years later in Syria at a spot between Aleppo and Antioch. He lived and died in the Eastern Roman Empire before the Great Schism, and so is venerated in both the Orthodox and Catholic churches. Evidence of his existence and his story come from three source documents that recount his life. He took to religion at the age of 13 after reading the Beatitudes, and at 16 entered a monastery. He didn't last long. So zealous was his faith that he embraced austerity in such a manner that he was deemed not community-minded and asked to leave. So what does a young chap do when chopped out of a monastery? While many of us would turn to drink and women, not our chum Simeon, he decided to go to further his career by going full on with his program of austerity. David Cameron and Nick Clegg would have loved him. Today he would be venerated as a model citizen by the Tory party. He locked himself in a hut for 18 months and spent the whole of Lent not eating. No worries for him about empty supermarket shelves nor petrol queues. But this was, as you might imagine, insufficient for him. As we were reminded for many years by that chap Stanley Green, who used to walk up and down Oxford Street with a placard proclaiming, "Less lust, less protein, meat, fish, bird, egg, cheese, peas, beans, nuts," and sitting. Sitting is wrong, and Simeon spotted this early doors. Having served his time in his hut, he moved on to practice a regime which entailed standing all the time. Out of his hut, he felt that the distraction of the world was not right for a God-fearing chap, and so restricted himself to an area that measured 20 meters in diameter. This was good training for what was to come. By this time, his reputation had spread, and many of the faithful flocked to see him. This really wasn't what he was aiming at. He was trying to escape the world, and yet the world came to him. And so he took the next logical and life-defining step. Well, actually a few steps, and most of them in an upward direction. In Tel Anisa, where he lived and where there were some ancient ruins, including columns that reached the sky, and so Simeon shimmed up a pillar and stayed there. Although Deliveroo wasn't around in those days, he was able to sustain himself, as local boys would bring him bread and goat's milk, which he pulled up in a bucket to his platform on top of the pillar using a pulley system. On the basis of the tallest poppy theory, local church elders decided to take Simeon down a peg or two and ordered him down off his pillar. The basis of their request was that if he refused, it was clear he was up there for reasons of pride and vanity. If he came down, his reasons were judged to be more wholesome. The order was given and Simeon came down. The elders were impressed and allowed him to return. If he had refused, they would have pulled him off. As time went by and his fame grew, Simeon found that he required to distance himself further from the crowds that he attracted. His first pillar appears to have been little more than 3 meters high. He gradually rose, ending up on a 15-meter, that's 50-foot, high pillar. He plonked a small platform on top on which he lived. Edward Gibbon, in Decline and Fall, described his daily life. In this last and lofty station, the Syrian anachoret resisted the heat of 30 summers and the cold of as many winters. Abbot and exercise instructed him to maintain his dangerous situation without fear or giddiness, and successfully to assume the different postures of devotion. He sometimes prayed in an erect attitude with his outstretched arms in the figure of a cross, but his most familiar practice was that of bending his meagre skeleton from the forehead to the feet, and a curious spectator, after numbering 1,244 repetitions, at length desisted from the endless account. The progress of an ulcer in his thigh might shorten, but could not disturb this celestial life, and the patient Herbert expired without descending from his column. He didn't spend all his time in prayer. He preached to the multitude who came to see him and was known to write letters. Some of his letters have survived, but sadly I was unable to find any examples. To start with, he added a pole to the top of his pillar to tie himself to during Lent so he could refrain from sitting or lying down. As he aged and relented and allowed himself a quick sit and a lie down on occasion. As his fame grew, so did his following. The Byzantine Emperor Theodosius and the Empress Eudocia were followers and sent three bishops to offer medical attention when Simeon became ill. He declined and miraculously recovered. He wrote to the Emperor Leo with advice. A wall was built around his pillar to give him space and a little privacy. And then one day, he was found dead, bent in prayer. Over the following century, he spawned a considerable number of other pillar dwellers, or stylites as they became known. His relics were, after a dispute with Constantinople, held in Antioch, and a church was built on the site of his pillar. Some ruins of this church remain to this day. And more than all of this, Alfred Lord Tennyson wrote a poem about him, which, like Tennyson's other poems, is too long to recite now. But here's the opening verse. Although I be the beast of mankind from scalp to soul, one slough and crust of sin, unfit for earth, unfit for heaven, scarce meet for troops of devils mad with blasphemy, I will not cease to grasp the oath I hold of sanctum and to clamour, mourn and sob, battering the gates of heaven with storm of prayer. Have mercy, Lord, and take away my sin. I think Tennyson's unfair. There's no evidence that Simeon was aiming at sainthood. That was just a consequence of the frugal and good life that he lived. While taking a brave stand and being martyred can appear eccentric, having a surreal fable about you might set you out from the crowd, and performing post-mortem miracles makes you a zany sort of guy. Actually, sitting atop a pillar for most of your life and setting a precedent that many others would follow surely places you head and shoulders above all wacky saints.
Well done, Clive. I think you're getting applause from around the room. I think your Catholic education has been vindicated. And Holmes, it turns out it was sensible making him go first, because he actually gave us the like set us up for almost a sensible thing about what a saint is before it basically all goes to shit.
Exactly. I mean, it was good, but if only we could all remember Clive's prologue. But, you know, I've made a few notes. We'll see where we get. Is he the patron saint of anyone, Clive, apart from attention seekers?
I'm not sure that he is.
Does Clive get bonus points for as many veiled references to knobs by 7:20 as he could possibly fit in, and as much double entendre relating to knobs?
I mean, it could be a factor if they're all equal at the end, which, you know, I don't want to encourage people to do a hurried rewrite and get more and more explicit as we go on. But so, I mean, is it true, this story?
It is true. There is historical evidence of it. This is why I think he's more interesting than people like George or Christopher or some of those other weird and wonderful people who fought dragons and carried baby Jesus across rivers, because his life was documented. There are three accounts of his life, and it does look as, and his letters do survive to known historical figures.
And then he was very popular, so people turned up to see him. Do we know roughly how many people turned up?
I'm not sure, but he was up there for a long time. So kind of over the 30 or 40 years he was up there, I would guess quite a lot.
What did he do about toilets, or is that not documented?
Not documented as far as I can see, but that's why they kind of had a perimeter wall so he could shit off the top. Or maybe he used his pulley system to lower the bucket, I don't know. But also, he wasn't eating that much, so he probably didn't kind of do a lot.
How wide was the platform? Would he not fall off when he was asleep?
It was wide enough for him to be able to stand or sleep up there. I'm not sure quite how wide it was. I don't think it was that wide. I mean, before he went up, he survived in a 20-metre diameter circle. It was probably considerably less than that, but not huge.
I mean, the only issue I have is the attention seeking, really, because if he really wanted to devote himself to God, he could have gone into the wilderness and gone up a high tree and no one would have known him. He could have stayed up there for ages, yeah?
Except he was attracting crowds before he even went up a pillar. He went up a pillar to avoid the crowds. It's a bit of a kind of catch-22 situation.
That doesn't sound like the most effective way for avoiding crowds to me, really. There are disguises. Well,
I don't know. Have you ever been up on the fourth plinth, for example? It could work.
Not recently.
Well, I didn't see if you did.
And also, I mean, at one point you said the elders told him to come down because he was attention-seeking, and he did come down, but that is just the action of someone who's going to go on to attention-seeking in the future, isn't it? No, I'm not attention-seeking, but now I'm going to massively attention-seeking.
If he was just going to doggedly stay up there because he wanted to stay up there, he would have stayed up there. But he was obedient, and obedience is a big thing in Christian hierarchical affairs.
I mean, he did do what he was told, but that's quite a literal approach. To come down off that column, you're attention-seeking. All right, I'm going to go back up now. I mean, it just sounds a little bit like a really old David Blaine. We know that he can be a bit irritating.
But David Blaine would have got into the bucket, wouldn't he?
He might have done. I doubt David Blaine would have come down when the elders asked him as well, to be fair.
That's true.
He'd have done that. He'd have waited till the end and then that eye thing on his hand at the elders that he did with Eamon Holmes on GMTV once. I mean, it's eccentric, but it's not really wacky enough to me at the moment.
Well, I know that kind of around your part of South London, there are people on top of lampposts all the time, but up in Islington, we don't have that type of thing.
No. Well, there's a reason for that.
Right. It doesn't sound, Clive, like that one is quite bonkers enough for Holmes. We'll see how it does. Should we go fishing somewhere else? Who should go to next, Holmes?
Charlie.
All right, let's do Charlie.
Oh, I've got to get my notes up. I made notes. Prepped.
Of course you did. You're a girly swat.
Total girly swat. I'm proud. Mm. Yeah. Okay, so you know those people who just won't shut the fuck up?
Quite a few of them in this room.
Boy, Chris, can't
get a word in edgeways with that guy.
Boy, do I have a patron saint for you guys. The talkative, the ranty, the natterers, even worse for the chuggers, the telemarketers and the evangelists. Because my nomination for history's weirdest saint is Saint Denis of Paris. In the 3rd century, Denis, as he was known at the time. I'm not going to do the French accent. We're just going to call him Dennis. It's fine.
You're going to be like one of those really annoying football commentators that has to suddenly pronounce Kanté's name in perfect French.
No, I'm going to totally leave that out in the manner of Clive and bring it to life with a Cockney accent. No, I'm not ready. So Dennis rocked up in Gaul from Rome on a mission from the Pope. And that mission was to convert the pagans of Paris to Christianity. At least we think he came from the Pope, because the limited sources that I've painstakingly researched online cannot seem to agree. Once there, he hooked up with a group of 6 bishops who were already in Roman Paris called the Apostles to the Gauls, and he assumed command of them, becoming the first bishop of Paris. Now, his backstory is as unverifiable as any storyteller could wish. Some believe him to have been not Dennis, but Dionysus the Areopagite. I don't know. I can't pronounce it. Who converted to Christianity in Athens under the Apostle Paul. He was sent to Gaul following Paul's death to join up with the bishops, along with 2 companions, Rusticus, who I assume was a pizza, and Eulithurius. Again, I can't really tell you. All these names are not great for me. Unfortunately for Dennis and his mates, the emperor at the time was not fond of blathering bishops banging on about our Lord and Saviour anywhere under his control, and he quite enjoyed persecuting Christians. So he ordered the arrest of the apostles to the Gauls. Dennis and his 2 travel buddies were the first to be apprehended, tortured, and beheaded at Montmartre. As a sidebar to this sorry tale of Christian persecution, it's either heartening to know or a sign of just how arrogant a winning ideology can be that I didn't know that Montmartre is probably not named after the Christian martyrs made up on the hill, but after the Roman god Mars. This change was described by an abbot to the monastery Saint Denis in the 9th century in the place formerly called Mont de Mars, but then by a happy change, Mont des Martyrs. So there you go. We changed names of things. But that's not the end of Denis's story. In fact, it's only the start of his legend, for not even decapitation could cure this loquacious lad of his verbal diarrhea. Mansplaining all the way to his place of execution, Denis found that he was miraculously able to continue preaching after his head had been taken off. Realizing his good fortune, he picked up his bonce and carried it off as witnesses to the improbable sight stood dumbstruck as the chatter faded away from them. Probably. I know I would. Denis went off for a lovely little walk and talk, not stopping to consider his good fortune or even to draw breath. But this is what I wonder, does a talking head need to breathe if it's not attached to lungs? I guess it wouldn't. It
could just... it's not really that big a deal, is it?
You don't need to breathe. You're kind of dead anyway, so you can just keep talking. Anyway, 2 miles. He walked and talked for 2 miles until finally, and to everyone's surprise, he died. Only then did he zip it. This first Parisian martyr, was he the first or just the first to be canonized again? I can't answer this for you. Was buried at the site of his eventual demise, and the Basilica of Saint-Denis, I can't resist it, sorry, the Basilica of Saint-Denis stands on the spot today. Next time you're in Paris, it's well worth a visit because it's the burial place of all the French kings. It would have been wonderful if the revolutionaries hadn't have smashed it to fuck and dug all the bones up and chucked them in a mass grave, but it's still an amazing place to go and there's lots of funeral effigies. It's really cool. While you're there, maybe you could light a candle to Saint Denis for the history hack down the pub regulars. We'd appreciate your prayers. Thank you.
That's really good. Do you know what? Kit has been struggling with his sound the whole way through that, and he's like, seriously, what's she saying? I've got Charlie coming through so quiet that there's a decapitated guy who's crapping himself. Which is not far off what actually happened. Holmes, what do you make of that one? Is that more lunatic for you?
It is more. I mean, I don't know if it's the mood I'm in, but even picking up your head after you've been beheaded and walking 2 miles is also a little bit attention-seeking, really, isn't it? It's more the type of thing that I had in mind, but I mean, it's, you know, comparing it to Clive's, it's not very believable, though. How is this documented and recorded?
Well, this was written down many, many, many years after his death, hundreds, in fact, of years after his death. I did write it down in my notes, but can I find them? No.
Was that on the basis that if someone had put it out 20 years after his death, people would have thought, bollocks. But well, 100 years' time, they thought, well, maybe.
Well, no, this is the thing. So it was, they made a what do you call it, an abbey. So he had his own sort of abbey with his own monks there to Saint Denis. And then the legend of Saint Denis was written by those monks. So it feels very much like how do we get people to give us money and come and see us and all of this stuff? We'll tell them about this story. The monks of Montmartre in the 7th century believed their residence to be the true site of Saint Denis.
So this sounds a little bit like
my own notes as I'm talking to you, because it was hundreds of years after. But if it had been eyewitness accounts, would we have believed it any more than a few hundred years later?
Not necessarily, but it sounds a little bit like, wasn't it, Glastonbury Abbey, where they pretended that they had King Arthur and Guinevere there as a sort of tourist attraction. It sounds a little bit like that. But the actual Basilica of Saint Denis, if we're going down that route, pronunciation, I hate that. I hate it when people go to Reims, because they go, you go, where have you been? To France. And they go, Rhem.
Yeah.
And then you go, I always go, where did you go after that? Because then they'll just say it in English.
Yeah.
but the actual basilica, does that mark the spot where he was initially beheaded or where he died after walking 2 miles with his head?
Yeah, it's the spot where he died that they built the what we now know as the basilica. And it's not the original basilica, it's one that was, so it was on the site of that. That's gone. And then this one grew up later on.
Would he get bonus points, Holmes, if he'd run around like a headless chicken? Because that would have been funny.
I mean, it would have increased. I think it's quite slapsticky anyway, but that would have increased the slapstick quota. What was his head saying while he was walking for these additional 2 miles?
He was preaching the word of God. So he was trying to convert pagans.
He sounds like that guy outside Stamford Bridge who does the Emirates as well. When you come out the station, he just goes on and on and on with his microphone and no one's paying any attention to him, you know, because it's football. He sounds like that guy.
I mean, you'd have thought at one point he'd have at least said, you know, avez-vous un anodin or something like that. Just email the text.
That's Nurofen migraine needed. You need the hard stuff when your head's come off. Yeah.
Okay, well, I like that one. Nothing more from me at the moment.
I have a question for you, though, Holmes. Is realism coming into play with your judging?
It might do. I guess because we haven't got fixed criteria. I'm just going to go with the one that I liked best. And if I have to defend my choices, I'll just use any old bullshit at the end. I think we'll just
proceed on that. There you go. That should make it easier for them. Who do you want to go for now? I'm going to let you choose all night. Who would you like next?
I'm going to try and go with people who normally go last. So I'm going to go Kit next.
Okay. So my pick for a saint is so astonishing that the word is even in her name. It is Saint Christina the Astonishing. And believe me, she lives up to it. So Christina was born in Brustum in modern-day Belgium in 1150 AD. She was orphaned at a young age and raised by her two sisters before she became a shepherd. So far, so normal, until age 21, she suffered an epileptic fit and dropped dead. But not for long, because when the townsfolk gathered and held an open casket service for her, mid-funeral, she suddenly sat up upright, completely fine, back from the dead. That is not the astonishing part. On returning to life, she announced to the congregation that they all smelled really, really bad and she had to get away from them, at which point she began to levitate into the rafters to get out of whiff range. The townsfolk, understandably scared witless, thought that she was possessed, and when she finally came back down from the rafters, they threw her in jail. While locked up, Christina shared her version of what happened. She had died, as everyone thought, and was on her way to heaven when she was given a chance to free souls trapped in purgatory if she returned to earth and took their punishment instead. She had agreed, and that incident had woken up in her coffin. On her release from jail, she did just as she'd promised and became a penitent, living a beggar's existence, wearing rags and refusing all accommodation, and of course, going around telling people that they stank and levitating away from them. But levitation to get rid of stinky middle-aged people was just one of Christina's tricks. It turned out that Christina had become some kind of a 12th century Captain Scarlet. She was now indestructible. In the summer, if someone lit a furnace, Christina would rush into their home and leap into the fire, screaming how it was burning her alive. When she stepped out, she would be completely unharmed. During winter, she would throw herself in the Meuse River and try and drown herself for hours and sometimes days and occasionally at weeks for a time, screaming in agony about the cold. Several times she got caught up and accidentally swept into the local mill run and was bashed senseless by the mill wheel, going round and round in an attempt to be torn apart or drowned. Ultimately, of course, she would always emerge unscathed. On several occasions, she was chased through the town by dogs who would bite her repeatedly, only once again, she would emerge unharmed. Eventually, she was thrown into jail again for her own safety, only to be released once more into the custody of a local convent. Here she died at the old age of, in 1224, some 53 years after her first death. These feats, the levitating, the furnace hopping, and the free ride in the mill wheel, all have witnesses, including Cardinal Crusader and chronicler Jacques de Vitry, who met her and interviewed her. The first monastic account of her life was published only 7 years after her death, and included commentary from people who knew her personally. For the next few centuries, she was a major saint in Catholicism, albeit one that was never officially recognized by the Catholic Church, before being largely forgotten outside of Belgium. Today, she's venerated in the Limburg region, where, perhaps unsurprisingly, she is the patron saint of millers and people with mental illnesses.
Well done. brilliantly done, as always. But Beth wants to kill you.
You have ruined my birthday, Kit. She was my choice too. you are single-handedly responsible for my drinking this evening.
Are you gonna do your pitch anyway, or Google, or just get pissed?
Fuck no, am I doing it, because no one can win against Kit, so I'm not doing it.
Quick, Google Mad Bastard Saints.
Mad Saints, I'm sure.
But, although he appears to be coming to us live through a keyhole somewhere in Ireland. So, Dorman, have you missed your bus?
Yes, I have.
Where are you right now?
I'm next to a road in Dublin, well, specifically Ballintir, close enough to where my parents live. I fucked my connection, so
excellent.
Yeah, I'm here.
So Dorman is listening in at the moment, and hopefully we'll be home and we'll do his pitch. Because how can the Irishman not do the Mad Saints? It has to.
Even doing an Irish saint. That's how heretical I'm being at the moment.
Brilliant. How are you otherwise, other than your Blair Witching around Dublin?
It's been a week, I'll be honest. I have a shit ton of undergraduate essays I look forward to grading. But apart from that, you know, it's fine.
Brilliant. Okay, we'll come back to Dorman Holmes. Beth's face is a picture right now. Kit, so is Kit's, because Kit couldn't care less. Look. I love it. Own it, Kit. Just own it. She can't be
8,000 miles away. What's she going to do?
Exactly. There's a
bit, I'd be more worried about what I will do when we actually meet again in person.
Yeah,
sure, I have a slight one of those little knacker protectors that cricketers wear.
I've got a slight feeling
about getting cake in my face.
I've got a slight feeling Kit's driving license might be intercepted at the Great War Group conference.
Who knows what may happen?
A marker pen.
Who knows what will happen, really?
Some Sharpie additions to his driving license. Holmes, have you got questions on? I'm too scared to say Kit's pitch in case Beth punches me. Have you got any questions about the astonishing saint?
I think so. I mean, it's interesting that, you know, when Clive did his, I thought that was probably made up, and then Charlie's was probably made up, but now, I mean, this knocks it out of the park from the made up perspective. It's
you're starting to let go of the realism requirement here.
And I found myself googling one bit as well. I'm sure they did, the furnace didn't exist in the 12th century, but then I realized it's probably the rest of it's probably bullshit as well. So I thought I stopped looking up the furnace thing because I probably didn't think that was a clincher. But the bit that I didn't get, so I get the bit that if she was just brought up by her sisters and was a lowly shepherdess, how come she had a big like state funeral in the town and there was an open casket?
That was traditional for the time. So anyone who died in the town got an open casket funeral. It wasn't sort of like, you know, they kicked them out. That was just how they did funerals. She was just a lowly shepherdess, and the people came together to say goodbye. And lo and behold, she levitated and told them they stank a lot.
Yeah. That's the bit I don't get, because I heard you say that, you know, she died and then she was on her way to heaven, trapped in purgatory. And then the bit that I didn't make notes on, because you were talking too fast, was they said that she could go back. But what was her purpose when she went back?
So her purpose was to basically take the suffering for the people in purgatory. So she was doing their penance, which is why she was sort of dressed as a penitent. She was a beggar. That's why she threw herself in furnaces and all that kind of stuff. The calling people smelly wasn't just a medieval thing. It was, they stank of sin was her thing. And so she wanted to get away from the smell of sin.
What's brilliant is that if Eleanor Yanniger was here, she'd rip you for saying that medieval people smell bad. She'd go on a high horse again about medieval hygiene.
Well, that makes
I think Londoners smell bad, so.
That makes more sense, because I sort of misunderstood that she was supposed to come back and spread like God's word. And I thought she's got a really fucking weird way of doing that. But that was down to me misunderstanding.
No, there is no God's wording with Christina. Although, if I want to be magnanimous, Beth, do you want to take on any questions?
Nope.
No, I would just like to hate you from afar, please.
I will if you win, which your kit, so you probably will. I am sharing this victory.
And then how come it 53 years later, how come it didn't happen again? Or had she done enough penance by then? Was everybody released from purgatory?
I it's not specified. She just dies of old age, you know, as living in this convent for the rest of her sort of her days. That's her retirement home, essentially. And apparently she was a very quiet, dutiful monk who would, like, you know, old nun or whatever, who obeyed all of the instructions that she was given. She was crazy, but she was a polite crazy.
And when did she stop levitating?
She stopped levitating when she entered the convent. So it was just when she was walking around town and she'd bump into, you know, Chris or Clive, and she'd go, "Oh my God, you stink!" and just start flying away from them. I know, not that either of those two have any sin, by the way.
I think Clive's saying he's got one sin there. I think we can guess what that is. Okay, yeah, no, nothing further from me. Are these just going to get progressively even weirder now?
Yeah, I think so. Well, we're not sure because Beth's frantically Googling another saint now and shaking her head. You ain't happy.
Oh, did Charles I of Austria Hungary? You know,
I'm now going to have to do this drunk as well by the time I actually find something and you get to me.
I mean, Beth, given what we've had so far, you could probably just fucking make something up.
Yeah. See if you can find a saint from the West Midlands.
Yeah. There is one, actually.
To be honest, you are the most Catholic person in here, so if you can't find one...
Ahem!
Shut up, Dorman.
I've got as much chance of finding a saint from the West Midlands as you do as three wise men and a virgin.
Yeah, this is true. Holmes, who would you like next?
I think next...
Clive, just for clarification, Clive says not a virgin.
Is he talking about himself? We knew
that. I'm
not
sure.
No, about saints from the West Midlands.
Okay.
Hang on, what about James?
Oh. Is it worth canonisation if you've managed to get to, how old is he, 25?
No.
I think incels,
I can be that easy.
Oh, there's less temptation on the South Coast. Zach is on the non-alcoholic Bellinis and appears to be pissed. Excellent. Holmes, who did you want next?
Well, on the basis that Dorman and Beth need a bit of time, it's got to be... I'll go for Zach, I think.
Thank you for not making me do mine on the bus surrounded by strangers. I do appreciate it.
All right, then. If you're going to be a saint, you don't want to do things by halves. Being the patron saint of just one thing is, frankly, plain lazy. To show true commitment to patronage, try being the saint of not one, not two, but 11 groups of people. Enter Saint Fiucre of Bruil. It's a place in France. I can't pronounce it properly. And what's folks, that was... Well, it's spelled Bruil, so... Make what you will of that.
Yeah, the actual saint's name, I couldn't get that either.
That's spelt F-I-A-C-R-E. He's Irish, if that helps. And Dorman probably hates me for my Irish pronunciation.
I'm going to go with Bruy as the name of the place.
Thank you, Lockie. That helps. So yeah, this guy's name is Fiucre, not something else. I know how your minds work down in this pub. The guy's an Irishman, as I say. Please, no quibs about the Irish. And he lived for 70 years from AD 600. Fiucre was raised in a monastery and became a monk. After emigrating to France, his first significant act was a bit of light farming. Legend has it that Saint Faro agreed to give Fiucre as much land as he could entrench in one day. According to which accounts you read, Fiucre therefore whipped out his magic staff /spade/hoe/whatever and started toppling trees and uprooting bushes. The giggles around the pub have started already. A local woman ran screaming, why wouldn't you? But specifically screaming witchcraft to Faro. Faro ignored her, apparently recognising the work of God, And at that point, from that point on, Fuchra wouldn't let women come anywhere near him, and particularly not anywhere near his hermitage, except his sister. And this is the next thing that Fuchra does that he becomes famous for. His blind sister traveled to his hermitage, became a nun, and it is said that through Fuchra's wisdom, she miraculously regained her sight. The 19th century folklorist and Catholic priest John O'Hanlon, clearly an authoritative source on these questions, informs us that, quote, through his merits, St. Fuchra had an inspiration that his sister would recover her sight, while to her, in like manner, was revealed the spot where the body of St. Savinian lay. There, prostrating herself, she poured forth her soul in prayer, and her face bedewed with tears, she would not rise from the ground until her petition was heard. She was restored miraculously to the youth, to the use of vision. None of this is particularly spectacular or wacky, though. What is remarkable about this guy is how many things he became a patron of. His hermitage in France became known as a place of healing. He had an interest in medicinal plants, but is attributed to have been a skilled medic because of his use of his delicate touch. Now, that all sounds well and good on the surface. Kings were trying to heal scrofula like that well into the 17th century, just ask Charlie. Becomes a little bit more curious when we look at the sort of things that Fuchra was healing with his lovely hands, because he is the patron saint of individuals suffering from infertility, hemorrhoids, and sexually transmitted infections. It is possible, and I certainly hope, that the reality is that he was healing people through his skill with medicinal plants. However, according to the Catholic Encyclopedia, and I'm quoting here, his fame for miracles was widespread. He cured all manner of diseases by laying on his hands. Fuchra has actually become the patron saint of many groups besides the afflicted. So cab drivers, unofficially, that one's not recognized by the Vatican. And it goes back to the Hotel de St. Fuchra beginning to hire out carriages in the 1650s. Florists, hosiers, tile makers, box makers, gardeners, vegetable growers, and pewterers are all included. However, how much Fuchra managed to really achieve through the use of his magic staff and his wonderful hands, I'll be honest, we'll never know. But his collection of patronages alone makes him a worthy contender for consideration, at least, for the title of perhaps greatest saint. And the use of his delicate hands when it comes to hemorrhoids and infertility, well, let's be honest, that's just classic history hack.
It is indeed. I think you broke Chris. I don't know if he's got his sound back, but he's absolutely in pieces right now. You're all right there, mate.
Fine. All good.
Excellent. So we've had magic staffs and lots more double entendre in that one. Holmes, is that what you were looking for?
No, I think actually I could now announce that, you know, Clive is not bottom, put it that way. I think it was actually it was slightly dull. I mean, you tried to spice it up with, you know, by showing who is the patron saint of various organizations from at the end. He did a lot of agriculture, healed his blind sister. That's about it, really, isn't it? He healed other people? I mean,
he healed people's hemorrhoids and sexually transmitted infections. You know, that's surely got to be worth something.
Well, only to those who suffer from them. I mean, you know, those of us that have been clean for their 40 plus years on this earth, it doesn't have the influence that it perhaps would. I mean, because I noticed you said that he's the patron saint of cab drivers, but I think you said that's not recognised by the Vatican. Does that mean others are?
Yes, amazingly, including the associations with hemorrhoids and STIs.
Did that all go through at the time he was canonised, or can you add to them subsequently?
You can add to them subsequently. I think a lot of it relates to a period around the 1600s, when they actually moved him and they moved his body. And then in the process of moving his body, I think people began to realize more and more about how there were miracles associated with him. And so as different people became healed through their various afflictions, then he kind of gained these associations with those different illnesses. But the hemorrhoids thing and the STIs thing, apologies to keep raising this, but it is breaking Chris, so it is kind of funny.
Every time you say get the words magic staff in as much as you can, because every time you say it, he literally crumbles.
But yeah, apparently that's to do with things, you know, people were going to him with ailments and he was treating that.
They're quite specific ailments, though, aren't they? Couldn't he have
they just, are. I mean,
not in France.
In terms of a medical conditions, is he the patron saint of anything that isn't genital or arse related?
Not that I'm aware of. Right. Everything else is like gardening and floristry and stuff like that. So he wasn't dealing with sore throats or anything like that.
That, well, I mean, with that, even though his hand, he had healing hands, but given where they'd been, would you want him to? I mean, okay, yeah, nothing further from me.
Blaze does sore throats.
Right. On that note, I love that. Zach's just gone straight for the genitalia, which normally would work in this pub. Not sure if it's going to be tonight. Holmes, who would you like next?
I reckon we go Chris next.
If he can speak.
You don't want a magic staff in your throat.
Chris, have you been on the Korean drain cleaner at the back of your fridge again?
No, on the grounds of Chris's reaction, I'm claiming a moral victory tonight.
It might have something to do with the fact that he's already cleared out a bottle of wine.
Okay, I can do this. Okay. Right. Okay, Holmes will be fairly pleased that this is actually going to be quite brief, as my knowledge of saints and the ecclesiastry is quite brief, seeing as that none of them went to sea or in German boats. So obviously I Googled the topic and an article came up and my eyes fell on this choice. And it's kind of an odd occurrence that when you're watching movies or reading books, you see a character and think, that's kind of the thing I'd be. That's kind of what I'd be like. You know, for me, it'd be like Captain Nieder in The Empire Strikes Back or young Werther in The Sorrows of Young Werther. But when I saw this guy, I never thought I'd find it in a historical person. So Gamarus was born in 1717 in Lier in Belgium. And he was the cousin of King Pepin the Younger. He served his cousin at court in various important roles. And the king arranged a marriage for him to a wealthy noblewoman called Guinwere, which in medieval terms is like winning the lottery. You're already rich. You serve the king. You have a wife. Everything could be rosy. But it was then that he discovered that this wasn't all milk and honey, and that his wife was actually a mean-spirited shrew. And she was awful to the servants and awful to him. So he did what countless men have done over hundreds of years since then, which was go to war with his cousin. And he fought with the Belgian army, or with King Pepin's army in Saxony and Aquitaine for 8 years. And eventually decided after 8 years, he should go home and try to make amends with his wife and, you know, try and live a happy life. But when he went home, he found that his wife was still mean. She was horrible to the servants. She kept back money from them that they should be paying them. And she was just a horrible, horrible, horrible person. So he tried to convert her to active Christianity. That didn't work. So he decided to contemplate his devotions to God. So he built a chapel, which was at Nivezen. My French accent is awful, but it's Nivezen Donc, which is also in the air, apparently. And eventually he spent a lot of his time there devoting his time to God, but every now and then having to go home to his wife. But the marriage was so toxic that in the end he said, bugger this, I'm leaving. And he actually got a divorce, which in the Middle Ages, the sort of medieval period, was very, very, very rare. And he went to go and live in his chapel as a hermit. And Lier as a town grew up around his hermitage. And eventually he died in 774. He was later canonized. Apparently some miracles were attributed to him, et cetera, et cetera. His saint's day was actually the first Sunday of the 10th of October, after the 10th of October. So happy Gamarus Day. They're a triple brewed thing, triple, no, triple, sorry, brewed in Limburg, not in Poland. And that's it, really. He, I mean, as saints go, he didn't have a particularly wacky life. He didn't die a horrific death. He didn't kill any dragons, but or have any epic miracles. But he's a relatable character who had simply just had enough of his awful, awful wife, and decided to devote himself to what the things that he was interested in, to God, to simple life, much like someone else might devote themselves to the Great War Group and writing and stuff.
It's gonna say it's not a coincidence, Chris, that you went and found a saint who found a way to soldier on despite the presence of a complete pain in the arse for a spouse.
And he is, in fact, the patron saint of divorces.
I love it. So if he was your hero, all he needs now is a German admiral's hat and he's your hero.
Or marry the Kaiser's daughter. Either one. It's acceptable.
Holmes.
No magic stuff, unfortunately.
I feel you're going to fall down on this one because Holmes is happily married and is not going to empathise with you.
Yeah, well, I am. Yeah, that's fine. There wasn't much detail, though. All I just got was quite a lot about the nagging wife. There was a bit of about 8 years, then came back. His wife was still nagging. He built a chapel, spent a bit of time there, came out. She was still nagging. That was about it, really. Then you said, oh, he did some sort of miracles. Do we know what miracles he did?
No. To be honest, I was so enthralled by the idea of the nagging wife and the escape. I thought, this is pretty much where my dice lands. It didn't really say Ophelia either, so.
And then you said that he has a beer named after him.
Yeah, it says something about a triple brewed in Limburg called the Sint Gemurius. I don't know what that is. But
if you hold that in there, thinking that would score you brownie points with home.
I don't really like those. They're too strong, really. But they're called a triple because they've got three times the amount of hops that normal beer has in, which then means you need to put three times the amount of sugar in to compensate for the bitterness. And most of that, the sugar turns to alcohol, so that's why they're quite strong. It's not being brewed three times. I just thought I'd get that. And also, I thought at the start, your gratuitous Star Wars reference to Captain Nida, slightly obscure. You need to aim a bit higher than him. He lasts longer than Mr. Bronson, but not much longer.
Not much longer. Sometimes I think I'd be Moff Jerry Gerald at the beginning of Return of the Jedi, just pleading for more men and more time, but I thought that'd be even more obscure.
But it's interesting that obviously he's a candidate for patron saint, the ideal candidate for patron saint of divorces. But if only he was around a little bit later, because Edward the Confessor is the patron saint of troubled marriages. So if he could have got in there first.
That's the thing. Technically, he was before Edward the Confessor, but I think Edward the Confessor is for if you're going through marital problems, and then if you've gone all the way to a Chris Sam scenario, you've got your way to Gemurius, who will look after you through the divorce with his triple strength beer.
But by the sounds of it, and we might have to revert back to Clive for this, but Clive, can you have a patron saint for basically anything? Someone could apply to be the patron saint of the difficult shit or something like that.
Oh, hard stool.
All the magic patron stuff.
Saint of, absolutely.
Yep.
He had a magical staff too.
And I guess from what you've said, if you are the official patron saint of someone, do you still have to go through a procedure, get it signed off? Is there a committee somewhere that vets all this?
Well, yes and no. You can be a patron saint because the church, the Vatican says, assign you to one particular role once you've been canonized, or even many years after canonization. Or a particular group can adopt a patron saint. Like History Hack could adopt a patron saint that we could intercede to help us.
Oh, we're going to do that before the end of the night.
We could get that. So I can't remember. Chris, what was your guy's name? Garrulus?
Gemurius.
Gemurius. So he's the patron saint of the below average pitch.
You're pretty sad to be. But there were no boats this time, so you know.
Yeah, give him some brownie points.
But Holmes, if you look on Wikipedia, there's a list of patron saints of ailments, illnesses, and dangers, another list of patron saints of occupations and activities, that are patron saints, a list of patron saints of places and one of patron saints of ethnic groups. So Bob's your proverbial there.
Well, I've just found one in my mission to find one who's the patron saint of coffee.
I don't have time to Google while just in time. I'm a professional.
And sorry, I have to just, the patron saint against invoked against migraine is St. Aspirin.
I have a feeling tonight that we're going to find everything more funny than it is because it's so shit-faced, which is going to be
amazing. No, I've just had a really shit week, so...
Go for it. Have you got more wine? Crack it open.
No, it's gone now. I'm on to Korean stuff if I'm...
Excellent.
Do it, Chris. Do it.
Do it. Do it.
Do it.
Sorry, you broke up then. Oop. Who next? I reckon Lockie next.
Go for it.
Whoop, whoop. Okay, so I was initially thrown because I had quite a sensible choice lined up for this, who I thought was going to be a great call. And then the word at the beginning was, no, we don't want sensible. Give us stupid. So I've done some pretty quick work. I was going to mention this guy anyway, because there's quite a few saints associated with beer. And this is definitely one of them. And my first choice was going to be Arnold of Soissons. But basically, he was quite sensible in the sense that he encouraged people to drink beer when beer was safer to drink than water. So he stopped people getting sick. So that's just good sense, isn't it? No, so the one that I've gone for, who has definitely my favourite miracle story, is Nicholas of Myra, a.k.a. St. Nicholas, a.k.a. Father Christmas. We're going to park the whole business of flying round the world with a sled, and Beth's giving me a face now. Like,
is this because you're about to crap all over Christmas?
No, absolutely, definitely not. Not going to do anything like that.
Oh, I was looking forward to that. Go on then.
Oh, okay. I could do.
It's really legal though, right?
No, well, no, not really. I mean, the kind of whole Christmas miracle thing is to do with his association with giving secret gifts, okay? And he's patron saint of loads of things, Nicholas of Myra as well. He's patron saint of sailors and merchants, archers, for some reason, repentant thieves, prostitutes, children, brewers, pawnbrokers, unmarried people, so we're going through all the stages of marriedness here, students as well. But yeah, this legendary habit of secret gift giving is a thing associated with him, and it also kind of ties in with the prostitution thing, because basically he saved three women from being prostitutes by lobbing money through their windows so that their father could pay the dowry for them before they had to run off and go on the game.
It wasn't because he came in late one time and he told his wife he'd been out giving little presents to people with a load of reindeer.
Right. I mean, that kind of ties in with with his miracles, really, because he's got a few. The kind of saving women from prostitution is maybe his most famous story, but he's big on resurrections, actually, is Saint Nick. And there was one time when he was, it was like a period of famine in Myra, and some horrible, disreputable butcher had actually got hold of three babies that he drowned in a barrel and was going to cut them up and sell them as ham, which is really, really horrible. But Nick managed to intervene, resurrect the drowned baby. So he's often portrayed with like a barrel and some babies. And so he's ended up as the patron saint of children, or one of the patron saints of children anyway, kind of on that basis, which is a bit weird. The favorite story that I have, which is just hilarious, and I know exactly how this went. He also spent some time as an innkeeper, and what basically happened was the miracle purportedly is three men left his establishment, were attacked, murdered, and had all their possessions stolen from them. And then he found the bodies later on and managed to resurrect them and bring them back to life so they could go home. I know exactly what's happened here, all right? Three blokes have gone into his bar and got absolutely shit-faced and spent all of their money, okay? And so the following day, they've gone back home to their wives, who have said, where the hell have you been? And where is all the money that you're supposed to have brought back home to keep the family going? Oh, my God, you will never guess what.
I was dead a few hours ago, literally dead. I was coming home to give the money to the family and everything, but I was robbed and stabbed and killed, and all my money was taken from me. But good old Nick performed a miracle. He came out of the pub and brought me back to life. What a hero. That's exactly how that went. So he should be the patron saint of getting drunks out of shit with their wives as well. But fundamentally, he did other stuff too. He calmed some storm at sea, apparently, and was able to persuade some merchants to hand over some grain during another famine. And miraculously, the grain reappeared in their hold, so they weren't punished for it later. And so there you go. You can have Saint Nick, patron saint of saving drunk people's asses, apart from anything else. And some presents as well.
We like that. Presents and alcohol. What more do you need, Holmes? Is that going to cut?
That was a good one. And obviously, you know, it's Santa, basically, at the end of the day. The only thing that would have made that story better if they have said, if they didn't say Nick the innkeeper, they said Santa resurrected me. That would have been better.
Yeah. Yeah, with his reindeer. I think it's remarkable how he managed to move from southern Anatolia to the North Pole, by the way.
Holmes, go ahead. Any questions?
What, no, I was just going to... Is it because he seems to be the patron saint of a lot of things? Is that why he was picked as, you know, the Santa? I don't know.
I think apparently it is the kind of... the manner in which he gave money to this family to save them. He did it in secrecy because he didn't want to... how was it termed? He didn't want to kind of bring shame on them, because it was quite a wealthy family who, for reasonable reasons, had lost their fortune, and so he didn't want to bring shame on them by just sort of handing over a load of money to them. Didn't want to kind of make them feel bad for accepting charity. He wanted to do it very much kind of under the radar. So actually, he kind of flung a purse of gold through the window secretly, so he could the father could afford a dowry for the first daughter, and then did it again for the second, and then did it again for the third one. So it's the kind of secret nature of the gift giving that leans him towards that.
But that doesn't strike me as being particularly unique, although a nice gesture it was. There must have been loads of people that did things like that.
Oh, I dare say. Yeah. But did they also resurrect drunk people?
I don't know the answer to that. I mean, yeah. No, I don't know. I just wondered whether, you know, if it wasn't for him, would they have just picked another saint to be Father Christmas, Santa Claus? Because, you know.
I think as well, if Johnny was here, there'd be a lot more love for that saint, because when he gets to the, what I call the Kate Bush part of being drunk and starts doing his Wuthering Heights rendition, I think that's the point where he needs saving, right, Holmes?
I think he's beyond saving at that point.
I think the rest of us need saving at that point. He stands there with his arms out, doesn't he, and does the Kate Bush thing, which is amusing for the rest of us.
Well, you all might see it a week on Friday or Saturday.
Honestly, the fact that 13 of us are going to be in an actual pub together is quite funny, especially as I've learned tonight that you can actually get Zach drunk on non-alcoholic cocktails, because he's just, you know, he's basically reached the point after one of them where he sat there staring at Clive's changing color light in his office, his porno light, and he's just mesmerized by the changing colors. He's reached that point of drunkenness. Right, shall we go to a very pissed off looking Beth?
I think we have to.
You know what I'm more pissed off about now is that your kid's fucked off.
Yeah, I think he's lost his connection, hasn't he? And he's just gone.
There's a doorman as well.
Yep. Doorman's back. Doorman's off the bus. We've had a live from the bus coming into the Twitter chat. Beth, come on.
I couldn't find any that lived up to Christina.
Well, you definitely get to claim it if Kit wins now, because
I've got a full thing prepared as well.
Beth, if you want, you can do Joseph or Cupertino, and I'll just talk about how shit St. Patrick is.
I'm just going to wing it, because I've decided, having had a look at my options, because there are many, like there are options. I had options, but none of them matched up. So I'm going a different way. I'm not going for the win this time. I'm just going for sheer and utter. Basically, at one point, it's basically just me reading smut. So I'm just going to do that.
That James usually does, just read his...
Why not? Like, I'm just going to read some medieval smut, why not? But I had like a whole thing planned. Like I was doing like a little presentation for you guys. Because I was gonna say about the fact that, like, as one of the resident Catholics, a bit not many of you, if any, or maybe Dorman, maybe Clive, how many of you have books about saints in your house that were gifted to you as Christmas and birthday presents as children? Literally, this one says "Happy Christmas, Beth," from when I was about 10 years old. So, you know,
about three from Sunday school. But
yeah, I've got these. This one particularly used to belong to my mum. And as a nerdy swat, as we all know, I used to read this book because I was a know-it-all and always wanted to be the centre of attention. I would read this before school every morning when there was like assembly, because they always used to say, "Does anyone know what the Saint's Day is today?" And I'd go, "I do." And it was always me. It was always me because of this book. It's always me. And, you know, as a Catholic, saints take over your life. Churches are named after them. You're named after them sometimes, as people are in this room. And then you get to choose names as well for confirmation, which when you consider some of the names that get chosen for saints for confirmation, you know, they're supposed to be a guide for you as a future, as you become an adult, as a Catholic adult in the world. Considering some of the choices of people I know, I worry as to how they've turned out as adults.
Is Saint Bethany the patron saint of Disney?
Huh?
Is Saint Bethany the patron saint of Disney?
That would be my dream.
Or chocolate.
Dream. And I'm one of the Catholic people that's not named after a saint. So I don't get, like, I'm after a place instead. I'm one of them people. I've got a place name.
Ooh.
Yeah, so I've gone, rather than going with my crazy Christina the Astonishing, I loved that so much. I'm really sad. I was just going to talk about, it's a little bit crazy as well, but by potentially the best well-known of the night, except for St. Nicholas, now that I know that St. Nicholas is an option. But she is certainly more well-known than Christina. And I'm going to just pitch for Teresa of Avila. So she's, again, a fairly well-known saint. Her background, her maternal grandfather was actually a convert from Judaism. He was trying to escape the Inquisition. So converted to Catholicism, because that's what Catholics do best, getting people to come over to their side. But she was quite unassuming as a child. She was very pious as a child and so on. Her and her brother particularly were very, very into their religion. They were really well known for their piety. She was very committed to her religion and read widely in the lives of saints and devotional works of the saints and biographies and so on. But so much so that around the age of seven, and let's all, for some of us, it might be easier than others, if we remember the time when we were 7 years old, her and her brother, Rodrigo, were like crazy into their religion. They were fanatic about it. They were so inspired by tales of Christian martyrs and so on that they set off to seek their own martyrdom in Morocco. So they packed bags, did the classic running away so that they could be martyrs. But luckily their uncle found them before they got much outside the outskirts of the town that they lived in. So they didn't get that far. As she grew into a teenager, like all teenagers, her interest in anything that she'd had before being a teenager waned, and her religious zeal dropped a little bit. You know, she was becoming a young woman. Her tastes had changed quite radically as she hit puberty, you know, at that age in medieval Italy. Yeah, so she was, you know, reading tales of dashing knights and courtly love, as, you know, when you're 13 years old is all very nice and so on. But she had a period in time where she had lots of strife in her life. Her mother died. Her father was quite an irate, angry man, provoked a change and her return to her pious ways. So she went back to her religion and she decided to become a nun, a Carmelite nun. She had never been in the best of health, so she suffered from ill health for a long time. But as this ill health came into her life, she also started to experience visions as well, visions of Jesus and so on. And these intensified as well as she, you know, punished herself more and more for any perceived sins she may have had, and tried to offer herself more fully to God. She would see these visions and they would become more and more vivid. And it's these visions that she becomes really well known for. And it, you know, her writing is all about her visions that she had. And she was even involved, she did a lot of reforming work for the Carmelite order, for nuns and friars. But as I said, it's her visions. And I know I'm not going to win this, so I'm going to just read what is her, one of her best known accounts, which to me speaks of a young woman who is very sexually frustrated. And now seeing as she's a nun as well, like, she ain't ever getting any. So we'll talk about this. So in her one of her visions, best known writing, Christ appears to her as a young man. And it bears this quotation. "I saw in his hand a long spear of gold, and at the point there seemed to be a little fire. He appeared to me to be thrusting it at times into my heart and to pierce my very entrails. The pain was so great that it made me moan, and yet so surpassing was the sweetness of this excessive pain that I could not wish to be rid of it." If that's someone who doesn't want a bit of fun, I don't know who is. Moaning, spears entering bodies, thrusting. I mean, come on.
Clive, really?
Come on.
Clive in the chat has just put bottom sex, obviously. You're going to be in such trouble if your wife listens to this.
I'm going to be in trouble if my mum hears this. And I suppose one must suspect that probably the sexual awakening that she may or may not have had as a teenager that was then curtailed as she became a nun before she was really allowed to experience, let's be honest, the best part of life. It's then transformed itself into religious fanaticism and manifested itself in the visions. So while she's not necessarily crazy, she's definitely a horny, sex-deprived woman in the prime of her life who is crazy in the fact that her horniness has driven her to visions. So there we go.
Dorman says, "Crusaders just wanted to shag, discuss." I think everyone has come up. Charlie's just put title of your sex tape. I think everyone has inadvertently titled their own sex tape tonight. Holmes, what did you make of that one?
I thought that was pretty good given the amount of time that you had to prepare it. I mean, I don't know if it's an age thing, but the small passage you read out, whilst it could be, you know, sexual, but I was just getting indigestion from it. I don't know why that was, but I mean, I didn't come to the same interpretation that Clive did. But then again, I didn't go to public school, so swings and roundabouts.
That's what all that money paid for.
Also, I like the fact you implied that everyone read about dashing knights and courtly lovers when they were 13, which I didn't. I have a feeling Lockie didn't as well.
13-year-old girls do.
No, I mean, there was a couple of ripped up magazines under a bush near the school playground that time when I was around that age. But
I did.
Was that Lockie? Was that magazine? Was that called Amateur Courtly Lovers?
Yeah, might have rhymed with dazzle. I'm not sure.
Courtly Love Readers Wise.
I'm still reading about courtly love.
Wow.
Anything else?
Is she a patron saint of anything?
She is, but I haven't got that far. Hang on. Let me just get up the list.
You could have just made something up, like just shouted tea towels, watsits, or something like that. We'd have all believed you.
If there is one thing that I like consistency, and I like to be correct, and I will not be wrong. So she is the patron saint of Spain, sick people in religious orders, people ridiculed for their piety, lace makers, a place in Croatia that I'm not even going to try and pronounce, and a place in the Philippines as well.
And anal.
Oh, I love that. I'm quite disturbed that you started talking about the sexy stuff and Chris has turned his camera off.
Well, is anal the place in the Philippines or Croatia?
Very hard to get into. Got really strict visa requirements.
There's some sexual shenanigans you can do to get in.
There's some jokes about PCR tests on the way out as well. Holmes, that leaves us with one more, doesn't it? No pressure on the Irishman in the room for pulling out the maddest saint there is.
Yeah, I mean, I presume the expectation would have been, oh, do St. Patrick, but St. Patrick's shy.
Like, I tell you what, before you start, do you want to rant?
Yeah, I'll have a bit of a rant.
Oh, look, he's going to have some water before he starts.
I haven't ranted in a while. No, St. Patrick is genuinely shit because so much of it we know is bollocks. At least with the others, there's like that air of mystique. Whereas with St. Patrick, we've got like three documents that actually talk about the things he did.
Hang on, that's not stopped anyone else this night. So you weren't here for the first half, were you?
Yeah, I mean, I doubt he went around blowing up druids with his mind, for example. But everything that was written about him was that is popular myth was written by a monk, or rather a bishop in a place called Armagh, where they claimed he was buried. The reason being they wanted to attract tourists to there. The two things Patrick actually wrote are his confessio, which is him saying how shit his life was before he became a priest, and isn't that exciting, and a letter to a pirate asking for, can the pirate please give me my priests back? Which is very rock and roll. Patrick is a bit shit. So I haven't gone with an Irish saint, even though I think Brendan the Navigator, who I have talked about before, is kind of
legend. While we're on Patrick, but all we know about is him getting rid of snakes. Did he not even do that?
No, of course not. The Ice Age did that.
Oh.
Yeah, he wasn't even the first Catholic bishop in Ireland. There was a guy before him called Paulus? I can't remember the guy's name, but because no one cares about him. But he was the first bishop and he didn't do a great job. So Patrick was sent over because he knew the people. Also, he was fucking Welsh. So anyway, not sure why he's the patron saint of Ireland. But he isn't. There he is. But anyway, that's not who I'm talking about. So I'm talking about St. Joseph of Cupertino because he's quite close to my heart. Because when I was younger, I would visit my granny who lived in a town called Kilkenny in the countryside in Ireland, or a city of Kilkenny, which is in the countryside, not in Dublin. And whenever I had exams, she would ask my mother whether she should be praying to Joseph of Cupertino or St. Jude. Now, Joseph of Cupertino is the patron saint of exams in which you've only really studied for one thing. So basically the patron saint of question spotting. St. Jude is the patron saint of lost causes. So a bit harsh, but typically we lean towards Cupertino. He's the patron saint of other things as well, like aviation, astronauts, mental handicaps, students, and exams, broadly speaking. So he's a 17th century Italian, born, surprisingly enough, in Cupertino. And he experienced a number of visions as a child. His mother considered him to be a complete nuisance and treated him very harshly. He was purported to be slow, absent-minded. He wandered aimlessly around, mouth gaping open. And he coupled this with a vicious temper. So really all the makings of a fantastic saint here. He tried to become a cobbler, failed. He then tried to become a Franciscan monk and wouldn't be allowed in because of his intellect or lack thereof. He did successfully join the Capuchins. That was only for 8 months because he was sent away because he did not do anything correctly. Really, he's a fantastic character so far. He keeps dropping dishes and forgetting to do what he's told. And eventually his mom kicks him out at the age of 18 and he manages to get into the Franciscan monastery nearby as a servant. He was told to take care of the horses and there he began to grow as a person and the fruits of the Holy Spirit flowed through him as this claims. And through voluntary acts of penance, which Beth turned into an innuendo. So by viciously masturbating in the horse shed, he eventually was allowed study to become a priest. He was a very good and holy friar, but he couldn't to study. He was not particularly studious at all. But in his seminary exams, the examiner asked him the one thing he could remember. And he passed with flying colors and thus became a deacon and later a priest. So that's why he is the patron saint of students and exams, getting extremely lucky and winging it. The flying elements is because he used to levitate at random while giving mass. I don't know exactly whether they tethered him to the ground or whether they had like a net to stop him flying away or how controlled it was. But he claimed people saw him soar into the air when preaching. Maybe he was just a really good speaker. So they decided to hide him away from the public because obviously who would want that kind of tourism? Well, the Irish, but apart from that, no one else did. He spent the rest of his life somewhat in hiding. Occasionally he came out, performed a miracle to let everyone know he was still there. So he's the patron saint of air travelers, pilots, and students. And he was canonized in 1767. Boom, boom.
I love it. I just thought, you know, the bit about the levitating and tethering him to the ground. I just seeing that episode of Dad's Army with the barrage balloon, where literally everybody's getting dragged up at Warmington on Sea. Charlie wants to know, Dorman, as the go-to Catholic in the room, is masturbation in the horse shed a prerequisite to joining the priesthood?
I really hope not, because we're running out of horse sheds.
It really puts a different spin on Father Ted and my lovely horse for me that I wasn't expecting.
Sorry. I may not qualify.
But also, I mean, I was thinking when you said that, and then the one question that he knew the answer to, that question wasn't how much hay does it take to mop up in a horse shed?
I think we may have missed that, but Chris says he qualifies. Holmes.
Yeah, he's quite an interesting one. We had another patron saint of students earlier on, which how many patron saints did... When I was a student, I didn't think about a saint for all the 3 years that I was at university. Which...
I think students need all the help they can get.
It's true. I've read their essays.
And then when you started off by saying at one point he just wandered aimlessly around with his mouth open, and I thought you were talking about Jordan Henderson for a minute there. We're wandering way off track.
That's just the Irish football team, generally speaking.
Well, Harry Kane and his mouth breathing.
But then, another one we had tonight, there was a bit of levitation, but I guess that probably didn't happen. And then he said he went into hiding, came down, performed a few miracles from time to time, and that was it. Do you know what those extra miracles were?
Mainly levitating. I think the miracle is the fact he became a priest. But that's a tangible miracle. And therefore superior to blasting druids with brain power and stuff like that. And whatever else everyone else said when I was on a bus.
There are about 11 patron saints of students.
So, Dorman, have you ever told your students they should be invoking Joseph of Cupertino or St. Jude, probably?
St. Jude, more their cup of tea, yeah.
You mentioning that gave me horrible flashbacks of being back at school in an example and my deputy head at the time going, you must pray to St. Joseph of Cupertino, and saying things like, God only helps those who helps themselves.
Yeah, between that and the constant prayers to St. Anthony in my childhood.
Oh, St. Anthony.
I mean, I may be reading too much into this, but it sounds like Dorman has had enough of the new undergraduates already.
Week five. No time.
Anything else, Holmes?
No, nothing from me.
James has just dropped in. I don't think James has got a saint for us. Have you, James?
No, I've had enough religion today. I had to teach a class PSHE, which had enough religion in it to just... Yeah, no, that's enough for today.
To cure you of religion. Right, okay then. Let's go around the room and see which saint you would have gone for. Oh my God, God help me, I'll start with Beth. If you couldn't have your own before we find out which one of you is convinced, Holmes. Beth?
Oh gee, I just don't know which one I would have picked at all. I mean...
Could it have been Christina the Astonishing?
It might have been Christina the Astonishing.
Well, Kit's back, so we have one last rant at him.
No, I'm gonna let my rant fester and
until he gets back in the country.
Beth, yeah. He did call you a Brummie.
No.
I mean,
no,
that's unforgivable.
He stole her saint on her birthday. So,
oh.
James is like, what have I walked into?
James, as we know, last Christmas has been on the receiving end of a small part of my anger. It's much bigger, much bigger.
I think Dorman needs to pee. So, Dorman, who would you have?
I heard the first 30 seconds of Zach's, and his saint was Irish. So, Zach's.
Excellent. Zach, pisshead.
What were we even talking about? No, I have followed this. Just on the basis of pure kindness, and because everyone's probably going to go for Kits slash Beths, because that's a joint victory, obviously. Otherwise, she'll beat me at the Great War Group Conference. I'm going to go with Dorman just because he was nice to me.
Oh, just learning into Eurovision. Chris, think yourself.
I'm probably going to go for Zach and his magic stuff.
Oh, yeah. There's a surprise. He's still sitting there pissing himself laughing at the end. He just keeps typing magic stuff into the chat function. It just like literally the chat function is just magic stuff, masturbation, magic stuff, masturbation on a loop. Lockie.
Oh, I was going to. I can't really remember that many names of saints so far. There's been quite a few funny ones, but one that I did remember is Saint Denis, of course. And I did like the idea of a chatty guy that gets his head chopped off still won't shut up. And yeah, so I'm going to go with Charlie.
Brilliant, Charlie.
Got to be Zach and Jamie and his magic torch. I mean, that guy, he made himself a saint out of touching people up. I mean, legend, absolute legend.
Brilliant. Does that mean there'll be a St. Rolf in about 400 years' time?
Oh, too soon, Holmes, too soon.
I mean, so far as we know, the saint was touching up consenting adults who went there to be touched, so... It's all good.
We're cutting some slack. Clive.
I was thinking of going for Kit, but I think that actually Beth came in and stormed it with her patron saint of bottom sex.
Outstanding. Beth's now praying her mum doesn't listen to this. Beth.
I mean, to be fair, it is a birthday.
It is a Surely that should be her husband's birthday, right?
Oh, I've missed this group. I really
Surely that's for John's birthday. Kit, did we ask you?
No. I had a power...
there it goes.
Like, there's been another power cut.
I think someone's been invoking the patron saint of power cuts.
Yeah, that's Beth. Yeah, me. Beth has been praying to the patron saint of power cuts. We'll find out. If he comes back, we'll find out. Holmes, go on.
Well, I'm going to slightly fudge it in that I've got Beth down as the overall winner because obviously Christina, the astonishing, is the best one. But Beth sort of did that and prepared another one. So I've got Beth down as the winner on that basis. And it's her birthday.
Yes.
But in terms of the saints, I got Christina the Astonishing in first place, Charlie with Dennis in second place, and then Lockie with St. Nicholas in third place. Clive, you were fourth, just out of interest. Before you stop banging on about coming last, and there's some sort of paranoid vendetta in your head all the time.
Is fourth worse, though, Clive?
I mean, I don't know. Coming last is usually the best thing to do, isn't it?
Holmes, the Anthony Taylor of judges.
Zach wants to know, to be fair, it's her birthday. Whose sex tape is that? Right, okay. Brilliant. I've no idea what we're talking about next time, but we're logging off now to go and get drunk for best birthday, so we'll catch you at some point.
When our guests join us to talk about their work and their new book, the 45 minutes or so they spend with us is just a taster of all their efforts. So to this end, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest and greatest books. You can support them and you can support History Hack too. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep at it and bring you more amazing guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/History Hack, or just search on bookshop.org for us under the shops bit. Thank you for your continued support, and here's to your next great